Welcome to But For Real, a variety show podcast co-hosted by two therapists who also happen to be loudmouth feminists. I'm Valerie, your resident elder millennial child-free cat lady.
And I'm Emerson, your resident chronically online Gen Z brat. And on the show, we'll serve up a new episode every other week that will take you on a wild ride through the cultural zeitgeist, mental health, and beyond.
You'll definitely laugh and TBH sometimes maybe cry a little because this is a silly and serious show.
Buckle up, my friends, and let's get into today's episode. And so we're back, everyone.
Hi.
Okay. Fun-ish, interesting question. Something that I've been irresistibly asking anyone that I'm in a group with as of late because I'm just a curious George. So I want to know. And this is a wordy question, but bear with me. So what is a trick or life hack or something that you do or have or use that is just so fucking good that you could get up in a room full of people and be like, guys, listen, this is so good. I wish you peasants knew about it. And I'm here to change your life indefinitely. So what is that thing for you?
Ooh, damn. Well, first of all, I feel like if we ever have a super engaged listenership and everybody submitted theirs, that would be like a whole amazing episode. Yes. So mine is the hiccup trick. And it's funny because this came up in our team chat just a few days ago. One of our team members was like, guys, help. I have the hiccups and I have session in 5 minutes. What do I do? Have you ever had the hiccups in session or right before?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I've ever told you this, but when I was like in seventh grade, I created a list of the three things I hate most in the world, and they were fire ants, hiccups, and war, and it's pretty much still holds. So like if I get the hiccups, I lose my goddamn mind. Like I am
You're immediately okay. pissed. Yeah.
So whenever I discovered this, like, I don't know, 10 years ago or longer, I was like, thank God. So yeah, you take a washcloth, you put it over your glass of water, and you drink through the washcloth. So what it does is it forces you to kind of suction a little bit, like even more than you would like through a straw. And then a company went on Shark Tank and created a straw that does this same effect. It's obviously easier to in many places you have access to a clean washcloth. You're not always going to have your Hickaway straw with you, but I did buy one because I had to try it out. And this explains sort of the biology of what it's doing. So they say that, and this is the same with the washcloth too. The Hickaway can instantly stop hiccups by generating enough pressure while sipping from the device to lower the diaphragm while simultaneously activating the leaf-shaped flap in the throat known as the epiglottis. Doing this simultaneous two key nerves, the phrenic and vagus nerves, which are responsible for the hiccup, this allows the brain to reset and stop the hiccups. And the washcloth or the Hickaway straw work for me every time, and thank God, because I am a nightmare if I can't get rid of my hiccups.
Hiccups is one of those things where it's like, no matter how fucking old you are, if you get them, like, you're kind of going to crash out because it's like, just get out of here, you know?
Like I can't focus on anything.
No, I can't focus on, like, what business do you think you have here, hiccups, you know? Like, it's just goofy.
Oh my God. Okay, what's yours?
Anxious girly. Take a shot every time Emerson admits on this podcast that she has deep-seated anxiety. And so with anxiety comes our really fun little friend, nausea, babe. Oof. So I'm not a full anxious puker, but like the nausea be getting me. Shout out to my nurse friends that told me about this. Alcohol pads, you know, just like the little prep pads. Literally, for our people that are watching, here's my tiny little elephant purse that I got when I was living in Shanghai. And everyone's like, oh my God, this little elephant purse. But you want to know what's inside of it? Alcohol prep pads. Because we don't compromise on aesthetics here, okay? Ooh. You're feeling anxious or anything, you just rip one of these suckers open and sniff it. And I know everyone is kind of like, girl. But listen, I was the kid that was huffing markers. I was huffing erasers.
You're okay so far.
Hey, and I'm fine. So I don't know what it is. I'm sure there's like legit science-y stuff. I was kind of poking around a bit on the interwebs with this, but whether it's just the intensity of the smell, which we know for anxiety, pop a mint or a warhead, and then you're focused on it's the sensation of it, whether it's just that like isopropyl, you know, just like that strong smell. But I feel like after just kind of for a few kind of sniffs, it seems so stupid talking about it.
No.
But it genuinely works so well. That paired with pushing on the acupressure spot in between your two tendons here. Shout out Melissa Tears for teaching me that. Yeah. But so good. And just I always have them in my like little purse just in case. It keeps them in my car. And so I feel like the Zofran fairy a bit where I'm like, have you ever had a Zofran? But I'm like, have you ever had an alcohol wet wipe to sniff? I'm like, this will help you. But yeah, this is like a very beloved trick amongst like night shift nurses and everything like that when it comes to dealing with nausea. So I was like, wow.
So I am going to have to poke around online and see if it supposedly works with like motion sickness too, because I don't get nauseous a lot, but when I go to like a amusement park, which I love to do, if there's any of the like the virtual reality style rides where you're like seeing screens and shit, I always have to take Dramamine, which makes me tired because like I get so nauseous. So I'm going to be busting out my alcohol pad. Also, I kind of like the smell of it. Not going to lie.
I really like the smell. It's like a guilty pleasure. I'm like,
she be sniffing.
Now it's time for our first segment, Tea and Crumpets, where we tell you what we can't stop talking about this week.
I don't know if you follow this guy on Instagram. He's at Mr. William Spreck, S-P-R-E-K. But his name on there is Tell Williams. He's a therapist. He's like a pretty flamboyant dude and he's like gorgeous and hilarious. His content is so good. And he's been doing these videos recently where he's dressed up as Satan. So he's like topless with a little like crit. And it's just, oh my God, the red like faux leather. And he's just like, oh my God, Pam, we have been waiting for you, Ice Queen. Like, it's so good because it's basically like these fuckers in Washington are one-upping Satan himself. They're like icons down there. So highly recommend checking those out.
I have been really trying to pivot myself into longer form content. I think I shared a bit in Breakfast Club where I was like, I'm coming home at night and doing nothing but scrolling and it makes me feel like shit. So trying to meet myself where I am with minimal energy. But instead of scrolling, I'm trying to get back to my like 2016, 2014 YouTube roots where I just loved YouTube. So D'Angelo Wallace, he makes like social kind of commentary videos. Okay. But even though I'm coming home and watching them at night, they still feel, it sounds weird to say like digestible enough when we're talking about social commentary, but it truly is. And I really appreciate how he's very thorough and how he puts his videos together, but they're mostly 20 minutes a piece. So kind of more on that digestible realm, but it's really interesting. And I feel like I'm coming home and quote, watching the news a little bit, like getting plugged into these large kind of social things that are happening. I recently watched his video talking about Melania Trump and like her movie, you know, documentary that came out or whatever. He talks about AI, Elon Musk, you know, just like anything kind of in the zeitgeist. But just really cool and interesting. And he's a really great guy. So highly recommend his videos. Now it's time for Step Into My Office, where you get advice from your favorite professionally qualified, personally peculiar therapist. Dear Val and M, I am a 32-year-old married man, and I genuinely don't know if I have a problem or if I just feel ashamed. I've been watching porn pretty much daily since I was 13. It started like curiosity, obviously, but somewhere along the way, it just became part of my routine. No matter if the day was stressful, boring, or normal, it's like my brain automatically goes there. I've tried to stop a bunch of times, sometimes because I feel gross about it, sometimes because I feel like I'm lying by omission, and sometimes because I genuinely wonder if it's messing with my relationship. But every time I quit, I last maybe 3 or 4 days before I go back to it, and it makes me feel even worse about myself. I haven't cheated on my wife, and I don't plan to, but I do fantasize about other people a lot, and sometimes it feels easier to be in my head than fully present during sex. A few weeks ago, she found my browser history, and now she keeps calling me a sex addict. She's hurt, which I get, but now I'm spiraling, wondering if she's right. Is this an addiction? Is this normal? Am I broken? I don't want to hurt my marriage. I also don't want to feel like I have to white-knuckle my way through my own sexuality forever. Sincerely, stuck in the shame spiral. Wow.
There's a lot there.
Yeah. Any kind of thoughts off the dome that's speaking to you right now?
I mean, my first sort of question is, in acceptance and commitment therapy, we talk a lot about sort of like, you know, depathologizing, taking the judgment out of things of like, who are we to determine like what's quote healthy or unhealthy or what's right, what's wrong? Like if we are just sitting there arguing with our thoughts, we often don't get anywhere anyway. So they talk about workability. Like, is this workable for you? Mm. Is this helpful? And it sounds like this listener is really questioning and going like, okay, it's maybe it's not that like porn is quote unquote bad, period, for this person, but that the way that they are using it may not be the most workable in some of, you know, their goals for their relationship, et cetera. And then there's whatever is coming up for the wife on finding this. And of course, she's embroiled in all of our sort of cultural consciousness around this too, and maybe feels hurt or threatened or whatever is going on from that angle. So yeah, that's some of the first stuff coming up for me. What about you?
Yeah, I think I really like the workability piece. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this kind of example, you know, listener, this is a vignette in many ways, I think, of what we talk about in sex therapy and in couples therapy, where I really do like to open that conversation between a couple about porn. And I'm always very interested when people come in with, you know, quite a lot of like moral judgments about it and the layers of how we got there. And I always make my stance clear that I don't want you to come in and I'm like, well, watching porn's normal, so whatever. And because I do think it is, and I talk about that in sex therapy. And again, like what Valerie is saying, we look at this thing and we're trying to look at the moral kind of judgments and if it's normal and if it's good and if it's bad and the relationship that you have with it, if that's driving you in a way that feels incongruent or stressful, then that's certainly something for us to explore, right? And for something for you to explore as well. And, you know, finding the browser history, calling you a sex addict, a big fight ensuing, I don't doubt. I've talked through that in couples before. And, you know, just the label of sex addict, and that's why we wanted to talk about this, but why we wanted to say for the title, is sex addiction really a thing? I just think it's something that just gets throws around, of course, in a heated moment. But I think especially when it comes to how embedded porn is into the culture of being a man, there is just like an interesting way that we talk about that and how we talk about men watching or utilizing porn that I think is a lot of the time pretty misunderstood. I'll throw men that bone. I'm kidding. So much love. Yes, literally. But I think there's so much more under that surface than, oh, well, you're just a cheater and you're a fucking gross freak and you're out to hurt me.
Yeah.
There's so much in there.
Right. And there's, you know, there's also the, like the neuroscience aspect of this, right? Yeah. In terms of if this has been going on since like adolescent development with this person, this may be one of the only ways that this person consistently self-regulates. So with that, I would say we probably need more tools in the toolbox, right? If you don't have a lot of tools and this is your go-to, then, you know, that could create challenges for its own reasons. And then there's also the question around like, what kind of content are we talking about? Is the level of content, you know, that idea that you need kind of more and more to amp up the intensity of it. And then, you know, in comparison, your quote unquote real sex life might feel a little dull or uninspired. If it's not workable for some of those reasons, then that would be other reasons why I would encourage this person to get support from a sex therapist, even if it doesn't look like eliminating porn from your life or saying, yes, I'm a sex addict, which we'll get into more, that I think there are good reasons to do some exploration around the relationship with it.
Absolutely. We hear you stuck in the shame spiral, and there's a way out of that for sure. So keep listening. Thank you.
And now it's time for the DSM. In our DSM, all varieties of dysfunction, spiraling, and meltdowns are welcome. In this segment, we break down complicated concepts and common misconceptions about mental health, well-being, and tell you what we really think.
How we got from sex addiction to out of control sexual behavior, what the heck any of this stuff even means. And we'll start with the history around sex addiction. So this concept became popularized kind of, you know, 80s, 90s. in the 12-step world originally, this guy, Patrick Carnes, who formed what's now called ITAP, the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals. They do a lot of trainings now, but their sort of bread and butter and what really started them off was the CSAT training, Certified Sex Addiction Therapist. And so it was sort of this model that was like, okay, we're going to develop this like kind of CBT, trauma-informed, 12-step aligned program of a task-based model where people who are working with a CSAT are ideally working with them one-on-one. They're going to a CSAT group led by a therapist. They are also engaged in 12-step, whether that's SAA or SA, something like that, or SLA. And all of that kind of integrates together. And it is based in the addiction model, right? Of people kind of working through the 12 steps and saying, you know, I'm powerless over this addiction. I was trained up as a CSAT and when I was working at a residential treatment center where that was one of their kind of big specialties. And in hindsight, it's just very interesting seeing like, I mean, we know that all of this stuff, like therapy, treatment centers, all of it, while there may be a lot of people with their hearts in the right place wanting to just help people who are struggling, and that's very real. I'm not saying that like, oh, it's just corrupt and greedy, whatever. It is, they are industries, right?
Yeah.
And like any industry, there are going to be people who are looking at like what sells and how can I, you know, generate more revenue for my organization. The treatment center where I worked had a strong sponsorship relationship with ITAP. Mm-hmm. So they wanted a lot of us to get trained up, and we had a program for women and a program for men for sex addiction or sex and love addiction. So I went and got my fancy credentials. And then it wasn't until I was in private practice working on my own and finishing up my like supervision for that, that I was doing some CE training and it was about sex therapy. And I was kind of like, wait a minute, how is it that I know all I've done dozens and dozens of hours of training and, you know, work in this one area of sex addiction, but I don't know how to help people with their general sexual health or other sexual challenges. That seems weird. So that's what ultimately brought me into sex therapy training, where I learned about sort of the controversy between these areas of in the sex addiction field or in the sex therapy field. They kind of look a little suspiciously, which we'll get more into. But I just think it's very interesting that here in the South, where we are, there are, you throw a rock, hit a CSAT. I mean, maybe not quite that much, but there are a lot of CSATs here. And it's like this very, it goes unquestioned. It's like this very respected, like, oh, who has a CSAT? Who can see my client with porn addiction? And there are very few certified sex therapists. Mm-hmm. To me, that has a lot to do with the religious sort of ethos here and getting to kind of then observe that and be curious about it and know this is not how it is everywhere in the country. So anyway, soapbox, I just want to say that if you have only ever been exposed to the sex addiction model, I invite you to kind of curiously examine that throughout this conversation. Okay, so back to sex addiction kind of as a concept. It's never been formally recognized in the DSM. They did consider adding hypersexual disorder, but it because there's not sufficient empirical consensus and agreement around it as kind of a discrete mental health condition, they did not add it. It's usually put under like impulse control disorder if someone's getting treatment for that and using insurance coverage. The ICD-11, which is more the book that physicians tend to use, does have compulsive sexual behavior disorder under their impulse control disorders. And then the World Health Organization in 2019 said that defined that as persistent pattern of failure to control intense sexual impulses or urges resulting in repetitive sexual behavior for over at least 6 months, causing marked distress or impairment. So like I mentioned, there are a lot of places where the term sex addiction used in sort of behavioral health, mental health care is just the unquestioned norm. But there are other terms too, like compulsive sexual behavior or out of control sexual behavior, which is there's a whole book for clinicians written by Doug Braun-Harvey and Michael Vigorito, which is an excellent. And we'll kind of talk about what that really looks like in contrast. Or, you know, you might hear problematic sexual behavior. So it's not about saying that, oh, well, we don't believe in sex addiction, therefore, like all these behaviors are just fine. Like, absolutely not. There are times where these behaviors are like wrecking people's lives and they're deeply distressed about it. but it is just challenging. Like, is the addiction model the one right and correct way of examining this? The other thing too is that the concept of addiction means that, okay, it's sort of inherently pathologizing and it's identity based of like, once an addict, always an addict. So I've got to like remain in this 12-step program for the rest of my life and identify as an addict. And if I don't, I could slip back in to the behavior. There's another book that's more written, not necessarily just for clinicians, but for anyone, by David Lay, called The Myth of Sex Addiction. And so I pulled just a little snippet here describing the book. So he's a clinical psychologist and he's contending that this label is driven by moral judgments, the label of sex addiction, driven by moral judgments and economic factors, and that it pathologizes normal male sexuality by judging it against female norms while ignoring underlying issues like relationship problems or other compulsions. So he does advocate for holding people accountable for their choices, not necessarily looking at it like, oh, you just have this disease, this sort of like internalized demonic force that is like in control of you. And then, of course, all the gender stuff is interesting, too, because, of course, there are females who also struggle with sexual acting out or tend to be more in the sort of gender norms in the sex and love addiction realm of the 12-step world.
Thank you for just like all of that background. I think it's so important. And I don't know, I think this topic is so interesting and I'm still such like a baby in the sex therapy world. And I know Valerie feels very passionate about this. So I was like, she's going to come in here with the sauce, honey. So let's keep expanding, right? And you may see us saying like OCSB, out of control sexual behavior, anything just to shorten it. But so of course, as opposed to the, you know, kind of quote clinical disorder, where framing out of control sexual behavior, and that's the term that I'm choosing to use, being framed as that behavioral problem within the normal range of sexual expression. So like Val was saying, you know, kind of rolling into the sex therapy world where it's like, oh, there's way more in here when it comes to looking at the health, sexual health alternatives. And then, of course, we're looking at the conventional thinking about assessing problematic sexual behavior, of course. So we're looking at kind of coining it more as that behavior problem than that process addiction or a psychosexual disorder, as maybe some other verbiage that you would see. So promoting those sexual health principles to envision and guide behavior change, which is really important. So some just common features to include in here. So we're looking at recurrent or intense sexual fantasies, urges, or behaviors, repeated unsuccessful attempts to reduce that behavior. Behavior is just ongoing, even though there's a slew of negative consequences, but there's just that strong desire and we're surpassing those negative consequences. Something I think is always really interesting to point out, significant time spent planning. So even if it's, you know, oh, I feel like I'm kind of over here, but if I'm really fixating on the next time that I can see someone or hook up with someone, if there's intense kind of, you know, planning or engaging in that, in those methods and or the recovery, if you kind of quote went out on like a hookup binge or something, and then you're just literally dead to the world trying to recover from that and feeling so steeped in shame. That's something to be curious about. Using sex to regulate an array of moods and emotions, feeling anxious or depressed or lonely. And then, of course, that marked distress and or functional impairment. So just an important nuance to throw in here too with the DSM, because, you know, honey, we always have that foot on their neck, as we should, but just the DSM requires that distress cannot be solely due to moral disapproval. So if we were using the lens of the DSM, feeling guilty because, let's say, your religion, Christianity or whatever, says masturbation is wrong, this does not constitute as like true out of control sexual behavior. But if we're looking at a loss of control plus that, you know, occupational or functional impairment, plus distress beyond that moral shame, then that's becoming clinically relevant. So kind of thinking of it as that equation almost. Yeah. This plus this equals blank.
Right. And you mentioned that like significant time element. And obviously it's different in every scenario. But I mean, truly part of the impairment can come from that piece of like it feels so compulsive. I remember someone I worked with in residential where she was struggling at work because she would go home in the middle of the day and do porn and masturbation and like miss, you know, hours of the workday. And so then was performance improvement plan and like all. So it's like really real consequences sometimes that can be very distressing. So looking at kind of the pop culture, social media narratives of this, which obviously we saw, we've seen some high profile people, the celebrity rehab arcs, you know, Tiger Woods, et cetera, that sex addiction in the media can be seen sort of as a punchline, like sort of people rolling their eyes at it. Like, are you kidding me? It can be seen as like a PR rebrand, right? Yeah. Like, oh, this person like maybe would be, because, and here's the, an important distinction too, is that sexual acting out that mostly just impacts the individual is very different from sexual offending. So even in the CSAT community, I mean, I'm sure there are people who have training in both and work with both, but they were always very clear to us that like, this is not, this is not training for working with sexual offenders. And even as a sex therapist, I've never, you know, wanted to pursue training and working with offenders because that's, I mean, everyone needs help, but that is not my expertise or interest. And so it is curious if we're talking like men or people in very, very powerful privileged positions, then we could see how potentially maybe there is some either offender behavior or just taking advantage of people in, you know, lesser powerful positions. And and sort of using addiction as like, oh, this is why they did this, right? So that PR kind of spin or like mitigating a scandal, right? So that's not to say that that's always the case. Like maybe there's a time where someone genuinely is in distress, or it might just be, oh crap, this person got caught. And now we've got to like craft a narrative that makes people feel more empathetic about their situation. And then of course, social media then brings in all of the TikTok therapists diagnosing strangers whose stories they don't actually know, influencers who are calling high libido addiction, like in the trad wife sort of like, Oh my God. Yeah. So there's all kinds of like things that get pathologized just because they are outside of the sort of whatever is considered to be the norm in that community. Purity culture, labeling normal sexual development as pathology. Like, yeah, of course, teenagers are curious and wanting to do stuff. That's literally the way they are wired. Let's just, how do we, you know, support them in doing that safely? Porn discourse oscillates between, you know, like this is empowering. And I see the same for like the sort of, you know, pole dancing burlesque sort of world. This is empowering versus this is either, you know, porn's destroying your brain or these things are, you know, actually cutting women down. And it's just very interesting. So very kind of chaotic messaging that you never quite know. It's like it requires a lot of groundedness in your own values, in your own experience, because otherwise it's very easy to sort of see one of these things and be like, well, wait, that's not, I thought this. So just, you know, be mindful that you are your own best filter. There's emerging research that explores how porn use is interpreted differently depending on moral frameworks. So again, we're not saying that it's like harmless all the time, because it's not, right? Some research tells us that it really can have serious impacts in certain ways. But looking at that with different moral frameworks shows different things in the research, which is interesting. It's, you know, OCSB is not about like, oh, if you have high desire, you have, you know, then you're doing this compulsively. It's about, you know, whether you feel agency over your own behavior and whether your patterns of behavior are harming your life and causing negative consequences.
Let's get into, like we were saying, kind of how this differs, right? I feel like also what's really important about this conversation is that through media or anything, it's very, or even just how I've talked to people that have been involved in SLAW, which is a 12-step sex and love addiction, if you don't know the catchphrase, because I was like, SLAW, like cold SLAW, right? What are we talking about? Gender, race, and like sexuality, okay? So this is where we're kind of getting real. Historically, Black and brown men have been hypersexualized, pathologized. Women, probably the most. Black women, the most.
Fetishized.
I put money on it. Asian women, you know, just like when we look at the differences there, culturally, what people pull from to hypersexualize somebody. And then, of course, our LGBTQ community has been labeled historically, in quotations, deviant, which is gross. And just the layers of that and the present layers of how people are talking about, you know, shaming the LGBT community, shaming trans people. It's just gross. And then women with high sexual desire have been shamed and pathologized as well. So these kind of hypersexual stereotypes have just honestly justified surveillance and or criminalization of all of these things, and how we compare this to a white man or a Tiger Woods or, you know, someone with influence, someone with power. We just talk about it so differently when it comes to not men. And then, of course, I think very specifically not white men. So I just wanted to make sure that we were bridging that here. And if you have any additions.
There, yeah, I mean, it just makes me think of sex work in this country. And
yes. Yes.
The, you know, lack of any sort of acknowledgement or dignity around sex workers. And yet, again, all of these, you know, let's say traditionally men in privilege and power who are utilizing sex workers, but not paying a price for it, not getting pathologized or judged for it. And so, yeah, obviously, there are other places in the world that have more rights for sex workers. And this this episode, you know, this is just a kind of a small sidebar. We could have a whole episode, I'm sure. But just looking at how the people in those positions are the ones who are getting pathologized and even criminalized for that work, not the people who are holding a lot of privilege and power.
Yes. Yeah. And that being able to look at sexual behavior, again, something that is liberatory in one context versus something else where it could be survival-based coping. Some of the research that we pulled for this episode, and we'll have plugged in the show notes, but sexual minority men report higher rates of OCSV symptoms because of a possible link to minority stress theory and trauma. Here, again, this kind of ability to have a survival-based coping rather than it being liberatory. And I talk a lot, especially amongst my friends in the queer community, with gay men in particular, and just how embedded addiction and sex has been for certain members of the queer community when you're a gay man. And so just part of my graduate school research, we were looking at minority stress theory and heterosexist experiences. And so trans and non-binary individuals, and I believe what we pulled from our research at large, of course, were more stigmatized and more affected by minority stress theory. Mm-hmm. And so then if we look at that, then here's something, here's this awful thing that's happening to me. You know, I feel so on the outs. People, I'm feeling othered constantly. And so here's one of the only ways I know how to go cope with that, which is have sex or use drugs and alcohol to soothe that. And then I'm not cared for, I'm considered a whore or a drunk or whatever by the culture or by the people in my life. So we cannot diagnose behavior outside of context. And it's just so important to me that we're really looking at the differences and how we talk about sex for some people where it is privileged and it's able to be liberatory. And then for other people, it has never been liberatory. It has just been survival.
Yeah. And one thing that I want to talk about as we start to shift into what actual treatment for OCSB really looks like, if we're not just taking a pure sort of addiction lens and model with it. Obviously, the workability piece that I mentioned earlier around like, is this behavior working well for you? Applies to the treatment side of it too. So like, if you are getting so much value out of your SAA meetings and your 12-step work, and maybe you're also doing therapy or whatever with from a sex addiction lens, if you're finding that super helpful, keep doing it, right? Like if it's really working for you, it's not a one size fits all. And I mean, my sex therapy supervisor when I was getting my ASEX certification was also a CSAT, and you don't see that a ton in the sex therapy world, but there is some overlap. And I think someone that I talked to even had run into Doug Braun Harvey, who wrote the OCSB or co-wrote the OCSB book, and they were having this kind of conversation. And he said something about like, I'll never correct a client's terminology. I'm like, not going to be like, well, you're not a sex addict, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it's really up to the client to determine the framing and the words that helps. I see part of my job is just like helping them see their options for that, their options for framing this and finding what works for them. But that really the question is like, again, steering them toward what does sexual health look like for you? Where does porn fit into your sexual health? And maybe some people feel like it doesn't at all. And that's okay. It's not my job to decide that. But ultimately, treating OCSB is not inherently about like abstinence-based or moral policing or, you know, any sort of shame-based, because we know that doesn't work. but it is about getting really curious about like, okay, what do you view? And this is one of the things that I picked up, the three circle plan. I don't know if it originated in the CSAT world, but that's where I learned it. And I find it so helpful because you can use it for so many things of like, what is your bottom line? Like what would be considered a quote unquote, you know, relapse for you or somewhere that you just really don't want to go again. And let's say it's like, well, that would be having sexual contact with someone who's not my spouse. Cool. So that's in your red circle. What's in the yellow circle? That's like slippery slope warning signs, red flags that you could identify that might lead you to that place if you don't take action, if you're not aware. And then what are in the green circle are the healthy sort of quote unquote recovery behaviors or healthy behaviors that you view as part of your sexual health that keeps you aligned with the integrity and who you want to be. So I think that framework is super helpful and just, you know, wanted to add that piece of like, even though we're communicating an alternative here, an alternative framework, it doesn't mean that you're wrong if the sex addiction framework works for you. But if we're looking at OCSB outside of that addiction model, again, it's a behavioral focus. And so we'd be bringing things in like CBT, like ACT, and maybe even medication, SSRIs or naltrexone can be helpful in sort of like emotion regulation and impulse control. And really looking at it in a deep way at sort of like the functional analysis of that behavior, like, and sort of the behavior chain of, well, first I think this, and then I think that, and then I feel this, and then I do this. And then, you know, like really breaking it down to where would I have to interrupt that? Where do I need to add alternative coping strategies? And then of course the trauma piece, the attachment focus and addressing any underlying trauma or, you know, even just kind of relational, difficult past experiences that might have contributed to this. So all of those pieces together, we're identifying triggers, we're increasing distress tolerance, we're building those alternative coping strategies, we're repairing attachment wounds, reducing secrecy and shame, and really restoring agency.
So, but for real, not every high libido is pathology. Not every affair is rooted in addiction, and not every porn habit is compulsive. And also, if your sexual behavior feels secretive or shame-filled and outside of your control, you deserve support and not a mean diagnosis.
Amen.
And now, our musical segment. Now that's what I call where Emerson and I each share a song with each other each week as representatives of our respective generations. We tell you a little bit about the song or artist, and then we press pause, we share the song with each other, and then we come back for our live reactions. And we're capturing it all on a Spotify playlist linked in the show notes for you.
My song for this week, and I don't know why I picked it. I know sometimes we theme these and sometimes we just do whatever. So I was like, this just came up and I was like, fuck yeah, I love this song. Have you heard of Ani DiFranco?
Yes. Okay. I think.
Well, so she was like core in the early 90s, like Riot Girl movement, GRRL. Okay.
Yes, yes.
She has her own record label called Righteous Babe Records. She started making albums, I want to say, in the early 90s. This was number 6, and she's made over 20 albums at this point. So kind of an OG, like, feminist singer-songwriter, Riot Girl. This is the title track off of her 6th album and released in 95. It's called Not a Pretty Girl. And one of the things that I thought was just a fun tidbit about Ani is that she has a nonprofit called Righteous Babe Foundation, where she's backed grassroots cultural and political organizations that support causes like abortion rights, LGBTQ visibility. She's definitely an activist spirit, you know, and she's had her own fumbles as one does if they've been in the public eye for 30 something years. But I think she's, you know, recovered pretty gracefully and is committed to like to doing the work. So
exciting.
This is Not a Pretty Girl.
I love the guitar. Like, I love, like, the track. Oh, my God. Just so good. I just, like, love when you show me shit like this because I'm like, wait.
Welcome
like,
to the 90s.
No, welcome to the 90s. You know I'm living vicariously through. And I'm just like, the girls have been feminists. You know what I mean? I'm like, it's just, like, such a good reminder where I'm like, no, the girlies were out here being like, I'm not a fucking kitten stuck up a tree. And if I was, I have claws and 9 lives. And so I'll jump down. I don't fucking need you. I'm like, wow.
God, so powerful. Like, even just like hearing it,
I'm spoken, just like, it's spoken word, it feels like. I'm like, whoa.
All right. What you got for us this week?
Okay. I have a song that I feel like has been, maybe it's like kind of on its way out now, but I'm always a little bit late to the party. But Die on This Hill by Sienna Spiro. Sorry, babe. Okay. I don't know if I'm saying that right. So this diva, she's born in 2005. You're kidding. I'm just sick. Hails from the UK. So I would say like she's having her TikTok moment. This has been considered her breakthrough song. It was released in October of 2025. She states that this song is about stubborn love, knowing you should leave, but not wanting to. She says this song has been, quote, a constant theme throughout her life, adding, I didn't write it about one specific story, more rather about a lifetime of stubbornness and showing up for people that never did for me. So everyone is really enjoying her Amy Winehouse meets Adele vibes, and just, girl, me too. The fuck? Like, I'm so excited to watch this video. I love her sound. So I just love it when a diva kind of like enters the internet ether. I'm like, wait, let's go. There's like this new girly here. So I'm excited for you to watch.
Okay. There's like so much to unpack there, because first of all, just like stunning voice, stunning aesthetic, like feel like you're dropped into, you know, 1950. And yes. Then she has this like genderless stuffed ex or partner that she rips to shreds at one point.
Yes. I just can't. I think her aesthetic feels very Amy to me. Yeah. Like I'm historically just like I've loved Amy Winehouse my entire life. But she just has grit, man. I just really enjoy that lately with the in the sea of the pop girls. So yes. I'm excited that you gorgeous. Got to her other, she has another song, You Stole the Show. Recommend that one highly.
Okay. Too. Cool. Mm. And I noticed that video was posted 3 weeks ago and already has 3.8 million views.
Yes.
The Hail. Oh my God.
She's beloved.
And now for our last segment of the show, welcome to Fire Dumpster Phoenix. It is rough out there, y'all, and we need all the hope we can get. It's time to go dumpster diving for some positive news and rise from the leftover Happy Meal ashes together.
A little bit of raccooning, a little bit of opossuming just through the trash, everyone. We're just wading through it, y'all, just to find some, you know, sparkles, some glimmers in this very scary, scary world. What is your good news this week?
Okay. So there's this like progressive magazine called The Nation, and they nominated the city of Minneapolis for the Nobel Peace Prize, which is so cool. It's in their March 2026 issue, and I'll just read a little bit. It's not that long of an article, but I'm not going to read the whole thing. So I'll just read a little snippet of this. It says, to the distinguished members of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, as longtime observers of struggles to establish peace and justice in the United States and around the world, and as editors of a magazine that is proud to have included several Nobel laureates on our editorial board and masthead, including the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we are honored to nominate the city of Minneapolis and its people for the 2026 Nobel Peace Prize. While individuals and organizations have been granted this prize since its inception in 1901, no municipality has ever been recognized. But in these unprecedented times, we strongly believe that the case can be made that Minneapolis, the largest city in Minnesota, has met and exceeded the committee's standard of promoting, quote, democracy and human rights and work aimed at creating a better organized and more peaceful world. So then they go on to talk about the fuckery that's been happening and the countless abuses, harassments, detentions that have been happening, especially in the city of Minneapolis, talking about how they've engaged in mutual support and care and just shown the fuck up, even in the dead of winter with little icicles on their eyelashes, Minnesota mascara, like just so inspiring to see. Like, we will not go down without a fight, thanks to people like the brave people of Minneapolis.
Fuck yeah. Oh my God. I just have chills. I'm so glad I plugged in mine too. I'm like, because this shows some of that direct to work. Mm-hmm. So the one I pulled this week, I titled it Minnesota Man Juan Leon is making me change how I feel about tow truck companies. Aww. 'Cause fuck them. Usually I've been towed across Nashville. Fuck you guys. So in the midst of Operation Metro Surge, Juan Leon of Leo's Towing has been returning cars to people impacted by ICE for 4 months, completely free of charge. He's been working alongside observers, is what the article quoted. So Leon has been showing up to arrests early in order to tow the impacted vehicles, work with family, friends, community to return the vehicles to people, or just hold them safe so that they can't be repoed or taken. He says that he receives private donations that allow him to do this work completely pro bono. And returning the vehicles can be really deeply emotional above anything, especially if someone's family members have been picked up and they're dealing with all of this uncertainty. And, you know, he says that it's tough work. It's not easy work to have to bring these cars back to people that are dealing with a lot of uncertainty, but, you know, that he continues to serve his community and he's not stopping and he's continuing to do that. And I just think it's so, yes, these people deserve a peace prize for all that they're doing in terms of, like you were saying, this mutual aid and coming together. And the more time I sat with this, I thought, you know what, man, I want to end this, or not, maybe not end this, but like, I want you to think of like your car, right? This thing that is like, is just a car, but it's not just a car. Like, this is something that takes you everywhere that you need to go. For us in Tennessee, like, this ain't no walkable.
Shitty public transit.
With shitty public transit, you know, like, we're so reliant on our vehicles. And there are times where I'm like, fuck this fucking car. I wish I could just walk everywhere. And that's true. But I think of just how much goes into owning, having a possession like that, something that you have to work for and take care of, and something that is a vehicle that literally can take you out of somewhere when you need to escape, that you need to hole up in, that keeps you safe. And
so it's opportunity.
Creates opportunity, man. And I just think, oh my God, I can foresee somebody being like, he's just giving people's cars back. It's not just about the fucking car. Right. It's about giving people something that they've worked damn hard for, giving them, helping them have something that they've worked for and that they deserve. And when you're being stripped of your identity and your rights and your basic fucking freedoms as someone that lives here, it's not just a car. So mini soapbox, but I just felt really strongly about this article. And yeah, good fire dumpster Phoenix for today. Shout out people of Minnesota. We really see y'all.
We do. And we will all hopefully use that as a model to step up, because shit ain't over.
It ain't over. So we'll keep pressing the pressure and all those necks. And yeah, we'll catch you at the next one. This has been another episode of But For Real, hosted by Valerie Martin and Emerson Ryder, and edited by Volt Productions.
But For Real is produced by the Gaia Center for Embodied Healing. The Gaia Center offers individual, couples, and group therapy for clients across Tennessee and in person in our Nashville office, as well as coaching and other programs for clients worldwide. For show notes or to learn more about our work, visit GaiaCenter.co or find us on Instagram @TheGaiaCenter and @ButForRealPod.
But For Real is intended for education and entertainment and is not a substitute for mental health treatment.
Also, since we host this podcast primarily as humans rather than clinicians, we are not shy about sharing our opinions here on everything from snacks and movies to politicians and social issues.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode.
See you next time, bestie.